I think we'll begin testimony on the Hortman bill, House File 1316. We do not have a quorum as of yet, so I'll wait for moving the bill until then. But I think we'll get started with that, and Representative Hortman is here. So, Representative Hortman, if you could begin speaking to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I miss very much serving on the Environment Policy Committee, serving with my friends Representative Cornish and Hoppe and Hansen and Scalzi.
Hi.
From last session. You may recall last session we talked a lot about mercury, and we went after reducing mercury emissions in Minnesota in coal-fired power plants because that is the largest generating source of mercury emissions in the state of Minnesota. I passed out two documents. One of them has a pie chart on it, and I just want to start talking about that one. There are many sources of mercury emissions in the state of Minnesota. And we recognized in the 2006 session that mercury is a potent neurotoxin. It's not healthy for humans. It's not healthy, especially for children and for pregnant women and their developing fetuses. When you look at the pie chart, you'll see that 42% of the mercury emissions in the state of Minnesota are from the coal-fired power generation sector. But there's another huge piece of that pie, and that's the 29% that's called resulting from purposeful uses. And when you want to break that 29% of mercury emissions down a little further, looking at the column on the right-hand side of the paper, you see crematoria emit about 70 pounds of mercury per year in the state of Minnesota, and fluorescent lamp breakage is estimated to release about 32 pounds of mercury per year in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to draw your attention to the backside of that pie chart document. This is a piece of paper put together, a report put together by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And what they have on the backside is the different sources for mercury emissions in Minnesota, how much those sources emit, and whether they have a low, medium, or high level of confidence in their ability to predict how much mercury pollution is coming from those sources. And you'll see with respect to fluorescent lamp breakage and crematories, their confidence level is low. In other words, the emissions from these sources could be much higher than those 32 pounds and those 68 pounds. I'd like to move to the next sheet of paper I passed out is an Excel spreadsheet with a lot of numbers on it. This is another way of looking at the fluorescent lamp breakage emissions. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency bases its estimates for these mercury emissions on the idea that 80% of Minnesotans are recycling their used fluorescent light bulbs. And right now, I don't know how many of you know where you're supposed to bring these when you're done using them. I don't know how many of you know that they have mercury in them. They're supposed to be recycled. But I would guess that it's not 80% of the people in this room, and I would guess that it's not 80% of the people in the state. Mercury Waste Solutions in Roseville recycles fluorescent light bulbs, and according to their calculations, if 30% of Minnesotans are recycling their fluorescent bulbs, instead we have 54 pounds a year going into the environment instead of 32. If you go to the far right column at the bottom of the page, and you look at recent information would show that about 8 micrograms of mercury can escape from the 4-foot tubes and light bulbs like this if they're not recycled. So we could be emitting as much as 173 pounds per year of fluorescent light bulb-based mercury in the state of Minnesota. So I present that to you to tell you why I'm bringing forward this bill. I think that mercury emissions and the health effects that they cause are a large problem in the state, and we really took a big bite at it last session with the Mercury Emissions Reduction Act of 2006. This is a smaller bite, and this is going after some of those other products and also the fluorescent light bulbs and the crematoria. Now, you may have heard a little bit about this bill before it came to the committee. It created a little bit of controversy in the electronics manufacturer community, in the motor vehicle community, and in the crematoria community. And we have listened to their concerns and incorporated all their suggested changes when we get to the point of moving the bill and moving the amendments to neutralize, you know, the strong feelings on this bill and show that what we're trying to do is take reasonable steps to control more mercury emissions in the state of Minnesota. Do we have a quorum yet?
We do have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order for the Environment and Natural Resources Committee for March 15th, 2007. We also have minutes to approve. Have members had a chance to look over the minutes for March 13th. Would someone like to move those minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of the March 13th meeting.
Thank you. Representative Breinhardt moves the minutes for March 13th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And Representative Hortman, if you'd like to continue, I know you have some amendments that you'd like to offer as well. We do have to, Representative Moe, before we begin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 1316 to pass and to be sent to the General Register.
Thank you. Representative Moe moves that House File 1316 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, the first amendment I'd like members to take a look at is the 807-303 amendment.
Okay, and I will move the 807-0303 amendment.
And to briefly describe what the amendment does before the committee votes, is this removes the report that was required to eliminate the fiscal note. And this also just contains some cleaned up language suggested by the Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you. I will renew the motion that we pass the 807-0303 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hortman, I'll move the 807-0353 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is offered for the purpose of eliminating the controversy related to regulating crematoria right out of the gate. This says that we are requesting that the University of Minnesota complete a study. They have expressed an interest in doing this, and so long as it's, there's no cost to the state of Minnesota and it's something that fits in with their program, that we would really like to see the results of their study and then act in the future.
And I will renew the motion that the A070353 amendment be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And I will move the A070346 amendment. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the one that I like the least, but I am doing in the interest of getting along. I take the National Electronic Manufacturers Association at their word that they are committed to clearly informing purchasers on the packaging of fluorescent light bulbs, that those light bulbs have mercury in them and that they need to be recycled. So this language is a little bit less prescriptive than the language we had in the original bill.
I will renew the motion that the A070346 amendment be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hortman, anything else to the bill as adopted?
Or I have a couple other amendments. There are two very small oral amendments. One relates to motor vehicles. At page 2, lines 19 and 20, the stricken language should be retained.
Okay, could you repeat that one more time, Representative?
Page 2, lines 19 and 20, the language that's stricken through should actually remain.
Okay. Representative, I will move Representative Portman's amendment that the stricken language on line 219 to 220 be reinstated. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Portman.
And the final oral amendment would refer to line 2.28, changing the 12 to a 10. And at line 3.9, changing the 12 to a 10.
I believe, Representative Hortman, that language was deleted in the previous amendment.
Some of it may have been, but...
Okay.
My understanding, Mr. Chair, that the amendment started after that 12. It started after the must on that line.
Okay. Now, the 12... Representative Hortman, we're wondering if the deletion occurs after the second must on page 2 or the first must. If it's the second must, then your oral amendment is correct. That language would still be there. So
I would
say, go ahead.
Second must.
Okay.
Then we're conforming to the same language they have in Vermont. So let's say after the second month.
Okay. And please continue then. On line 2.28, replace the 12 with 10. And you were saying on page 3?
Line 9. Change the 12 to a 10 as well.
Okay. Page 3, line 9, change the 12 to a 10. Everybody understand the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, I will move Representative Hortman's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce Karen Skoog to further explain the bill. But while she's doing that, what I'm going to pass around are fluorescent light bulbs that I purchased at Menards and Home Depot. The one in the little package, the little plastic package, has a very tiny indication that the lamp contains mercury, which is why we have a font size of 10 points, because I believe this is about 4-point font, and I don't think any consumer can really read that and understand that this light bulb has mercury in it. And then you can take a look at the other packages and see the more correct way of doing it. So, Mr. Chair, that's Karen's group.
Please state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Skoog. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And so I'll just very briefly walk through the different sections of this bill. It has a lot of sections, but they're pretty short. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Section 1 essentially just expands the recycling requirements for some mercury-containing products and includes the addition of fluorescent and high-intensity discharge lamps. Section 2, as amended, puts back, like we said, the stricken language related to the auto switches, and it also expands the labeling requirements for certain mercury-containing products, including fluorescent and high-intensity discharge lamps and the laboratory chemicals and reagents. Section 3 clarifies the requirements that were passed in 2006 for utility notification of mercury content in fluorescent lamps, just to keep it more consistent throughout. Sections 4 through 11 essentially deal with a number of different products. It bans the sale, distribution, and or use of a number of these mercury-containing devices for which there are proven cost-effective and available mercury-free alternatives. And most of those devices are medical devices like blood pressure cuffs, some switches and relays, thermostats, barometers, and such. The Minnesota Hospital Association was consulted, and they don't have a problem with any of these changes. And Honeywell has also indicated that they are already phasing out mercury from their thermostats, so we believe that all of these restrictions are very reasonable. Section 12, this is just a definition section of mercury-containing for clarification purposes. Section 13 requires that lamp recycling facilities report to the Pollution Control Agency on an annual basis the number and type of fluorescent lamps that they're collecting. Section 14 prohibits the use of elemental mercury and other listed mercury-containing devices in K-12 schools. It prohibits the purchase and use by December 31st of 2007, and then it provides a 2-year timeline for the storage and removal of these devices from the K-12 schools by December 31st, 2009. And the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators they looked through this language and consulted, and they didn't have any problems with these changes. Section 15 is the section that was just deleted related to crematoria. Section 16 requires retailers of fluorescent lamps to provide readable signage at the point of sale, and I believe We've been working with the Minnesota Retailers Association. They do have some questions about that piece, and I think that there will be a later amendment probably on the floor to change some of those requirements related to notification. And then Section 17 was eliminated with one of the amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Skoog. Any questions at all for Ms. Skoog or Representative Hortman? I believe there is another testifier. Is there a Catherine, Ms. Catherine Zimmer? Welcome, Ms. Zimmer. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Sure. Good evening, Chair Ekins and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Zimmer, and I work for the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program. For those of you unfamiliar with MNTAP, we are a business assistance provider at the University of Minnesota, and we assist businesses with pollution prevention, efficient use of resources, reduction of energy, and costs to improve public health and the environment. I've been the healthcare specialist at MNTAP for 10 years, and I've been asked to testify this evening specifically regarding alternatives to medical equipment, specifically gastrointestinal tubes and sphygmomanometers, commonly known as blood pressure cuffs, are referenced in the bill in Section 4. For about the last 10 years, actually, the healthcare sector has been working very diligently to eliminate mercury from their facilities. And so there are readily available alternatives to both the GI dilators, the gastrointestinal tubes, as well as the blood pressure cuffs. The gastrointestinal tubes actually now use tungsten. Most of the blood pressure cuffs are now aneroid or electronic. And you may have heard that earlier there were concerns about the accuracy of the alternative blood pressure cuffs, and those concerns have been addressed either on-site by the facility through internal calibrations or by the manufacturers. Also, substituting mercury-free equipment in the healthcare sector has really improved actually kind of their internal environment and saved them quite a bit of money. Hennepin County Medical Center, for example, is saving over $30,000 a year in spill cleanup costs alone associated with mercury-containing equipment. They no longer have mercury blood pressure cuffs or thermometers. And then another really key piece, I think, of this legislation is the labeling requirement in Section 2. Healthcare facilities have to comply with hazardous waste regulations, and as such, they have to identify the mercury in reagents, vaccines, chemicals, and pharmaceuticals. And these labeling requirements will be particularly useful for them as they move to make sure that they're managing their waste properly. And as a matter of fact, for some manufacturers, actually having the fact that mercury is in their reagents identified, they've actually moved to eliminate mercury from those reagents. The largest reagent manufacturer in the world has actually eliminated mercury from 6 of their 7 reagents and are working on the 7th. So, in conclusion, I believe this bill will be very helpful to healthcare facilities. It'll help them continue to eliminate mercury from them and also then ultimately minimize pollution to the environment and protect wildlife and public health. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Zimmer. Mr. Anderson, like to testify? Oh, Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know if you want to finish with people in favor of the bill before you go to opponents, but sure. The Director of Mortuary Science from the University of Minnesota is here to say a brief word about the crematoria issue, and there's I know somebody else who wants to speak in favor of the bill.
That would be good, yes, to have those in favor first. Yes, Representative Gardner, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a technical question for Representative Portman, if this is a good time, or should I wait?
Sure.
Thanks for bringing this bill forward, Representative Portman. I know we've talked about it a little bit. On page 5, line 23 to 25, there's the annual report for lamp recyclers, and there's actually an excellent one about half a mile from the family's business in Blaine. I know it's a very interesting facility. I'm wondering if you've talked to anybody about how the reporting would go. I think they usually measure things by weight when they get stuff in bulk and may not. They know what types of lamps they are, but if they get a pallet full of fluorescent tubes, they might weigh it rather than actually physically count it. I don't know I can't recall where your next stop is, but I'd be happy to maybe find somebody who can give you some input on the logistics of that. Just to make sure that we actually have something that is meaningful for you.
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, the AO7303 amendment got a little bit more specific at lines 1.11 and 1.12, that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency will specify the format for the report, and it will make the reported information available on their website. And I think you're probably familiar with John Gilkison over there at the MPCA and others who use this data to try to make estimates about mercury emissions in Minnesota, and they're interested in having better information so that they can make better estimates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, as usual, you have foreseen my question and have answered it. Thank you.
So, and Representative Saylor had a question as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, I'm just wondering, as you move along, I wasn't able to follow this as closely as I would like to have, but I have some questions about people that you've talked to in your preparations for this bill. Have you talked with AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties, and also with FSWA, the Solid Waste Administrators Association, the people that will be dealing with this at the solid waste facilities in rural parts of the state? This is reminding me a great deal of the e-waste bill. And I'm just wondering what conversations you've had with solid waste, city and county professionals in particular, and also with household hazardous waste managers throughout the state.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I have not had any conversations with those folks, and my understanding is that the folks working on this bill with me have not. But as a result of our many conversations about this issue in the last session, the language at 2.6 through 2.10 talks about people bringing these lamps to facilities that recycle them, including but not limited to those counties where the household hazardous waste site would pick those up. So in greater Minnesota, it is a little bit trickier of a problem because I'm not sure that residents of greater Minnesota are going to have as easy of a time as folks in the metro area to find somebody to take these bulbs.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, if I may answer also, we did consult with the Pollution Control Agency because they are sort of the liaison with the household hazardous waste county sites. And they suggested that because most county facilities already accept lamps and the major utilities have programs with a number of smaller retailers, mostly hardware stores, to accept the lamps, that they assumed that what we were proposing was adequate in terms of dealing with the waste.
And one further comment, Mr. Chair. Existing law forbids people from putting these in the garbage. And so the way existing law is you can keep them in your garage for forever. And what we're hoping to do with this legislation is say we really don't want them in your garage forever. We would like them to end up somewhere where they can be properly disposed of instead of breaking.
Representative Saylor.
Yes, and to that point, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to stress very clearly that, it's really, I think, important to speak to those county individuals because they're not always necessarily on the same page as the Pollution Control Agency. Often that is the case, but just to make sure that we're not inadvertently setting up some sort of problem, a situation that becomes problematic for the counties and ends up, again, costing them more money and, how to deal with it. It is true that most counties have places already in place to take the bulbs, and there are all sorts of organizations that are out there that are in place. I just want to be very careful that we aren't inadvertently, through some language somewhere, setting up something that leaves them in a position that is untenable, because things are different in different counties, especially out in the rural areas. And I know that can be problematic, and I guess I would just ask if maybe I could work with you a little more closely on this. As the bill progresses, it's a good idea. We want to keep the mercury out. I certainly don't have any problem with that at all. But sometimes just the method, we want to be, you know, really careful about that. E-waste took 5 years, you know. And so things can take a long time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, a prior draft of this bill before it got jacketed required the county solid waste people to accept these bulbs, and I removed that as a result of our roommate experience in Washington at the National Conference of Environmental Legislators.
And the testifiers, would you like to step forward in favor, if they would please come? Oh, Representative Olin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a quick question. Where is this bill going, or what's the status next? Because there may be time to correct whatever the question on the counties is.
It is going to the general register next, so it'll be going to the floor.
Same time.
Yeah. So,
good afternoon.
If you could state your name.
Yes, my name is Michael Lubrant. I'm the director of the Program of Mortuary Science. We're an academic program at the University of Minnesota in the Academic Health Center. I've been following the issue about mercury abatements from emissions resulting from amalgams, fillings that contain mercury when bodies are cremated. I've been trying to keep up the literature. This is what I've been able to find for the past couple of years. So a lot of people have been talking about this, and I think it's an important and interesting issue. My interest in this, I'm not here on behalf of the Funeral Veterans Association or any other professional association, but we are the only institution in Minnesota that trains mortuary scientists. And so if, in fact, some sort of abatement legislation were to pass where morticians would become responsible for abating mercury from teeth, there are currently no best practice guidelines for how to accomplish this. So my concern would be, as one moves forward with this particular issue, that there'd be time to study the issue so that we could make the appropriate recommendations for abatement. I've been following the Senate bills, the Senate committee hearings. I've been at those as well. It's a very sensitive issue. It's been studied extensively in Europe over the past decade. In Europe right now, cremation rates are over 70%, particularly in Northern Europe. They will not, for example, abate, remove teeth in Europe. That was part of their process. They had to do different technologies. And what happened to the United States is different. And so there was concern raised as far as if, in fact, you do process abatements through the removal of teeth, the removal of amalgam, how do you actually go about doing that? And that was something that I think needs to be approached with a great deal of care and sensitivity based upon people's personal religious beliefs, preferences, or the like. And the biggest concern I had when I originally saw this legislation was if it was immediately passed and something went into effect in the next few months, that there would be no way that we would be able to effectively train people to do an abatement in an appropriate and sensitive way. And I thought it might be helpful to discuss the issue at greater length, perhaps study the issue to see what would best practice recommendations be, were the legislation to move forward and be passed. Currently, we don't have anything like that in line right now. The Europeans decided to try to reduce emissions by 50% over 10 years between 2002 and 2012. Whereas here, as I've been following the legislation, it's been 100% within several months if the legislation gets passed. I don't think it's practical. And my concern would be if we want to abate, and I don't know one mortician that doesn't care about the environment and wants to see it happen, that there needs to be some sort of study for best practices to actually make this happen. Because if you don't have the buy-in from the funeral directors as the ones who would most likely be the ones doing the abatement, there's no guarantee that you would actually get the desired end, which would be the abatement of the mercury. Unless you go out and have a mercury police looking in people's mouths before cremation, you're never going to know if it occurs. And so I think it's important to work very carefully to bring people around the table. Colorado has studied this issue. In fact, they were working with Tetra Tech. I'm sure you're familiar with that organization. Pollution Prevention Crematory Project. This is their internal final draft report. They started this with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. They studied this issue starting this past year. What ended up happening was they started a stakeholders group, but about two, 3 months into it, the funeral directors and some of the other people who were involved with the project and the stakeholders, the dentists and other folks, pulled out from the project. And so right now, they don't have any process in place. They ended up saying, well, unless you mandate it or legislate it, we're not going to do anything. We don't know exactly how to respond. So I think that there's a start going. I've worked and talked with the people who have done this study, looked at their methodology. They've got some really interesting research questions based on, A, best practice for abatement, as well as looking at certain cultural issues that would be important, sensitivity, next of kin and the like for cremation families. And so I thought it might be an interesting thing to look at if we get funding to do a study such as that. It would be appropriate for our unit to take a look at that. So that was my concern.
Thank you, Mr. Lubrandt. Are there any questions at all? Okay, seeing none, there's one other testifier in favor. Step forward. Welcome, and if you'd like to state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Larson. I'm an attorney practicing in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm here representing Mercury Waste Solutions, Inc., and with me is Brad Buescher. He is the chair and CEO of the company. We are here to support Representative Portman's bill, and just to give you a little information from the industry on the recycling process of lamps in Minnesota. Mercury Waste Solutions is one of the largest lamp recyclers in the country. They have a facility in Roseville. They have a facility in Union Grove. I was talking about Roseville, Minnesota. About 5 million lamps got recycled there last year. About 1.5 million were from Minnesota. Mercury Waste Solutions also does other types of mercury waste in Union Grove. Did about 3,200 tons of other mercury waste just outside of Milwaukee. Really the business, though, that we're talking about here for Mercury Waste Solutions, and the thing we wanted to show you is the process that's used these days to recycle mercury waste lamps and how easy it is. This is a scale version of a lamp tracker box. This is a UPS-compliant box. It would hold about 65 regular-sized lamps and about 128 of the new T8 lamps. And this is a box that has a box inside. It's got a foil bag, and then it's got another box. It's the old box, actually, that UPS will carry because it does such a good job of keeping the mercury in the box. Generator, the types of companies that use this, Target, Walmart, Best Buy, Wells Fargo, Kinko's, FedEx, Yum Brands, KFC, Taco John's. It's an interesting product because the company didn't really understand how much generators were going to like this. You fill this up, you close it, you put it out for your UPS driver. The driver picks it up. When it gets to Roseville, Minnesota, in the computer system, it gets scanned, and you can go online with your company's name and get a recycling certificate right offline. Somebody from Target can manage all their mercury lamps with this product right from their desk. The interesting thing that we talked with Representative Portman about, and I understand the issues with regulating waste and determining costs of compliance, this is a state-of-the-art system that's really changed in the last 10 years. I'm not sure 10 years ago a lot of people would have thought this was a reasonable burden to put on people. This is proved to be across the country, not only by Mercury Waste Solutions, by other people. Common carrier recycling is really what's done. And it can work in small states. We work all over the country. It can work in greater Minnesota. It makes it very easy for people to recycle their lamps. Just a little bit more on the environmental impact of Mercury Waste Solutions. Those 5.5 million lamps probably contain something like 120 pounds of mercury. If you look at different calculations that you see in papers on how much mercury is released when you break a lamp, that 121 pounds of mercury would probably have resulted in somewhere between 36 and 100 pounds of mercury being released into the environment if people would have thrown those in a dumpster. If you compare those numbers, 35 to 100 pounds per year in one facility in Minnesota, to other things that are done around here to protect the environment from mercury, that's a pretty big number. We think that recycling rates could go up, and we think Representative Portman's bill is a good way to start that.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And if, welcome, and if you could state your name, please.
Brad J. Buescher. Mr. Chairman, I'm the I am the chairman and CEO and principal shareholder of the company that Peter just introduced. I too would like to applaud Representative Portman's bill and suggest that you favorably consider its passage. It strikes to the heart of a little known and misunderstood problem, which is although lamp recycling is an important and required ingredient. We have very low compliance rates across the country, and Minnesota is no exception, despite the fact that we have one of the tougher statutes in the books. And I'd like to leave you with the notion that this bill will go a long way toward establishing the mechanisms which will allow for some accountability, which we currently don't have, so that at future dates people can come back and actually suggest what are the recycling rates. And to coin a phrase that was offered by Jack Welch at GE some years ago, if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. And I think Representative Hortonville is a long way to accomplish that. It's for the first time we'll establish some parameters for some packaging standards, which currently is not done, because oftentimes these things are left, as Representative Portman referred to, in people's garages or in their basements, or perhaps worse, in their furnace rooms, which is right next to the primary air delivery system in the home. So with that, I thank you, and we appreciate your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Boucher. Morton? Oh, okay. Any other testifiers as far as in favor?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Kathy Moser from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has had some conversation with the county solid waste officials, and I was going to ask her to make a brief comment about those conversations.
Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Kathy Moser. I'm the Division Director for the Prevention and Assistance Division. We've had a couple of conversations relating to the counties and making sure that they were comfortable with the requirements in this bill. The first is in the household hazardous waste area. I have the program that sends the money to the household hazardous waste programs and coordinates with the regional groups. We made sure that they were comfortable with the language that would indicate that counties could be contacted. In addition, I presented this bill and some work that I'm doing in my division relating to mercury in schools to the Solid Waste Officers Executive Board a couple of weeks ago at our big air water waste conference. And you know, there's concern about how much money I'm spending in my own budget, but really not much concern about this bill that I heard.
Thank you, Ms. Mulger. Any questions at all? Seeing none, there was an old Mr. Anderson wanted to testify. Welcome, Mr. Anderson, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson with the Minnesota Retailers Association, and I don't want to be characterized as opposed to the bill. Actually, I'm trying to work with the author and with Ms. Scoob to try to find a way to make the bill better. And let me mention specifically what my concern is. Section 16, the signage requirement for retailers. Now, retailers tend to resist signage requirements anyway. For lots of reasons. It's expensive, there are potential legal obligations, and so on and so forth. And we also know that people tend not to look at signs. That's why we change signs in stores a lot. We try to figure out color schemes to get them to look at signs. And, you know, so we're always trying to figure out how do we get customers to look at messages that we want to give them. So anyway, out of curiosity, I'm trying to figure out what the sign might look like as prescribed in this bill. And so I started trying to do it on my computer, and I couldn't do it on my computer. So I went to just a local print shop, and Representative Hartman, I don't mean to embarrass you. Okay.
At least it doesn't say fan fun.
Right. So anyway, will people see that? Maybe, but then where do you put the light bulbs? I mean, it takes up a lot of space, particularly if it's a small store. And so we're trying to figure out, what's really the best way to communicate? So I tried to assemble some of my members from Home Depot and wherever else to get them to talk about what's the best way to communicate with customers. Is it by giving people pamphlets? And now they throw those in the parking lot. What about putting something on the receipts? No, they're going to throw the receipts away. They're not going to read it anyway. And we know they ignore signs. So what's the best way to do this? Interestingly enough, in talking to one of my members, they found out that they're actually trying to give these type of lights away in low-income areas in certain parts of the country, and people won't take them because they're different. They have a little bit different color hue. They can't always put lampshades on top of them, you know, but yet we want people to use them and they won't take them. So if you have a sign that says, caution, this lamp contains mercury, you'll probably scare the remaining customers away and we won't sell any of them. And I think we want people to use these. Now, interestingly enough, I talked to Great River Energy, a rural electric cooperative who serves some of our Representative Osmond's area, and is served by me too, and just a number of other, I think they have like 15 rural electric cooperatives in their group. Their goal next year is to get one of these lamps into every single customer's home. So that is 700,000 bulbs. Then they're going to try to double it, so it'd be 1.4 million. But it's interesting. I want to make sure that what we do doesn't have the opposite effect of what we're trying to do, and that is to get people to see bulbs. So again, what's the best way to inform the public? Well, I had a long conversation with some of my members this morning. We're talking about possibly working with Great River Energy and utilities, because utilities, I'm told by MPCA, are now putting things in their packets about, in their billing, about what do you do with these bulbs when you're done with them. We're talking about maybe working with environmental groups or even the state to maybe do some private funding for educational programs. And that's a conversation I hope to have with Representative Hartman by the time this gets to the floor, so we can come up with a wording that is most appropriate. It might be taking out Section 16 and putting something else in. I don't know. But I thank you for the willingness to work with us to find the right vehicle, and I thank the chair and the members for your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Any questions at all? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Horton and Mr. Anderson. I want to concur with your comments about not wanting to frighten people, because actually it is certainly in the best interest actually of reducing mercury overall, with reference to coal-fired power plants, you know, to be using these light bulbs. And I think you've correctly identified that one of the problems is indeed how do you get people to know about this. It's something that's been a problem, you know, whether it's too big, too little, too easy to throw away, whatever. So I appreciate the efforts that you have made in identifying that, and I think that might be part of, you know, further discussions on this bill, because it is important that we, you know, get compact fluorescent light bulbs out into more homes, and I agree with the intent of this bill, but, you know, just a few of those little things that we just maybe need to discuss a little bit more. But anyway, I think your point is well taken. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to echo what Representative Saylor said, and Representative Hortman, I would commend you for the amendments and working with people the way you have. And I don't know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but is this going to the General Register, Mr. Chair?
That is correct.
Are you willing to work with Mr. Anderson and try to find the best way to do this? And thank you. Good enough. I'll yield to Representative Leganius.
Representative Leganius.
Has anybody talked to our utilities about providing, I'm not going to advertise one particular product, but a product like this, this product or one competitor for Home Depot and folks like that to actually supply a certain number of these to counties, or working with the SIF program and supplying a number of these prepaid to particularly the counties where it would be difficult. Because if they can be mailed from International Falls, Hennepin County, they can be mailed from International Falls. And maybe that is an approach you could use that would work for both the retailers, the folks who are trying to use their SIP dollars wisely, and certainly this would be something that I would think they could spend their SIP dollars on, and then it would work for the counties.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leganius, I know you have a lot of bills on the calendar today, and I agree with you very much, Representative Leganius, and I think in between now and when we talk about this bill on the floor, we'll see what we can do. I'm actually surprised that a product like that isn't available at Home Depot or Menards right next to where you can buy the lights, because as a busy parent, that would be what I would do, is buy the light bulb and then buy the recycling container at the same time, so I didn't have to worry about it later. But we'll have some conversations in between now and then about how we might promote the recycling avenues that are out there. Thank you.
Any other questions? Anyone else want to testify? Seeing none, Representative Hortman, any final statements?
Mr. Chair, 8 other states have adopted a law similar to this, and in your package you have a number of public health organizations that are supportive of the legislation. And I appreciate very much the committee's time and consideration.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. Representative Moe, renews his motion. Their House File 1316, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed in the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Congratulations. And moving on to House File 1476, Representative Knuth.
Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I'd like to move House File 1476 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
And Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee and to the bill.
Thank you. I actually just had been in contact with the PCA, and they I have an oral amendment if I could offer that and put the bill in the form I'd like it. If you look at page 2, line 2.29, strike January 1st, and on 2.30, strike 2008, and after the word by on 2.29, after the word rules on 2.29, insert within a year of their final adoption by the agency. And basically, what this does is makes the bill fit the language of the PCA in terms of their rules about septic systems, and they suggested it, and I agreed with their assessment.
And Representative Hansen?
I would move that amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Knuth to the bill as amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this bill does is basically brings performance-based system individual sewage treatment systems, ISPSs, and allows these performance-based systems to be used. It sets up an advisory committee at the PCA and provides some technical assistance to the counties. Sets up an advisory committee. It basically creates some support for how these performance-based ISTSs should be used or could be used, and allows counties to do that. And then the language about local ordinances has counties come into line with the revision of the PCA rules. And I have a testifier who can speak much more passionately and knowledgeably about performance-based systems than I can, and so I'm going to turn it over to Dennis Fink, who's the St. Louis County Commissioner.
Welcome, Commissioner Fink, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
I will. I am Dennis Fink, St. Louis County Commissioner and past president of AMC. Thank you very much for allowing us to talk about this. AMC has adopted a position of 7 areas that we would like to see move forward to help us modify and use the rules of septic systems and our ordinances to better improve the water quality within our counties. One of those issues is this performance-based system. Another will be heard next week by this committee, and its point of purchase inspections of septic systems. For the performance-based systems, for years, emerging technologies have been coming into the marketplace where you can actually take the sewage, put it into a tank, do some aerobic adjustments, and then come out at the other end where there is, in fact, water that's pure enough to drink. But these systems are not widely used. We are still using old technology that talks about the separation of 36 inches or 3 feet from the drain fields to the water table as the basic technology and where we need to go. There have been a number of people studying this issue for years. We are now at the point where we want to be able to use these new technologies, and they will help us in a number of ways. Right now, as you probably know, every time a septic system is put in some, wherever it is, there's a requirement for both a drain, the current drain field that would be in use, and a second drain field in case of failure. If we can use performance systems, we can reduce the size of the lands that need to be set aside specifically for sewer treatment and still maintain the concept of having two set aside as well as the active drain field. We need to have some language in the ISTS bills that allow us to do that. This will help us get there. We also appreciate the fact that there would be a statewide advisory board that would help us look across the state and see what other counties are doing and what other organizations are doing in terms of both the development of these new systems and the development of rules and regulations that would help us implement those policies. So we're really excited about the possibility of having this particular point and, of course, the one next week on point of purchase be adopted by your committee, sir.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions for Commissioner or Representative Kunuth? Representative Arginius.
Yes, thank you. When you changed, amended it on page 2 to say within a year after the final adoption, we moved out the date, I expect.
Mm-hmm.
When will these rules be adopted?
If I could have someone from the PCA speak to that.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name.
Table with the Pollution Control Agency. Our rules are on public notice right now. We have hearings scheduled in April, and I believe, if everything goes as we hope, that they would be in effect in November of 07, so November of this year.
So, if I could, okay, if it's there in November, so then it's a year after November. That seems like a long time to me. It's not a long time to me. After a year after final adoption for counties, which will have notice of the rules because they're in process right now, so it's almost 2 years.
Just to say, Representative Arginius, when we were drafting the rules, we worked with the counties, and that was the length of time that they thought was appropriate to conduct all the activities they need to do. In part, because the people that work in septics are very busy during the summer months and they have more time in the winter, so they wanted to have an off season for sure to do the work. And then also because it just takes, nobody's going to know the actual language of our rule until it's through and final published. And we have a number of steps to go along, and there's a fair number of controversial items, and so they weren't willing to pony up on the draft, but rather the final.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is Ms. Sabo, I don't know. But I'm looking at the last page, Section 6 appropriations, it would be distributed through the Department of Ag. But, other places of the bill, it talks about the PCA. So I'm wondering kind of the tie-in there, if it's something with relates to the local water planning grants.
Ms. Sable, did you want to respond, or?
Mr. Chair, the appropriation. Do you want to answer it better? Basically, this is appropriation trying to get a little bit of more money into the revolving loan funds for the counties because septic systems are so expensive it can deplete the revolving loan funds. And from my understanding, the local water planning grants come from the Department of Ag. If you want to speak to that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, these are the Ag BMP loans that go out to individuals. This is the one pot of state money that's able to reach an individual without having a local government involved in doing the work. And the governor's budget actually has $1.25 million for this purpose now.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any further questions? Any further testimony? Representative Kuhn, any final statements?
I just appreciate your support.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
I renew a motion to pass 1476 and refer to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1476 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Bill passes. Motion prevails. Next we have House File 1663. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to move House File 1663 to pass and to be referred to the Government Operations.
Representative Moe moves that House File 1663 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have a couple of amendments. One printed amendment and another oral amendment. First, an oral amendment to the text of House File 1663, which you should have in front of you. On line 1.16, with at number 3 there, strikes state tribal leaders and insert federally recognized tribes.
Representative Moe moves that we amend House File 1663, line 1.16, to strike state tribal leaders and can state federally recognized tribes.
Correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman. And then since the two bills that we had before us, 1662 and 1663, are so similar in nature, we decided it's a single subject, and we'd actually like to amend the text of House File 1662 as an amendment that you have in front of you to House File 1663 so these bills can move together. There's also a few language changes in 1662 that have come about through work with the different stakeholders, and I will go through them after we approve the amendment.
Okay. Representative Moe moves Amendment A070354.
Correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Moe to the bill is amended.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to give a brief overview. We'll go through the bill briefly and then take testimony, if that's okay with the chair.
That would be good.
The need for this, first I'd like to remind everybody where we were with this. Anybody who has heard about this issue last year, we had it on the House floor. In northern Minnesota, native natural wild rice is an important cultural and spiritual asset for an economic asset for many of our communities. There are some current threats and potential future threats that many people in northern Minnesota, throughout Minnesota, band members and non-band members have been concerned about for years. And this issue came together as a combination of those concerns and efforts. The legislation before us attempts to do will do three things. The first is, if in fact there is an introduction of a genetically modified version of wild rice, an attempt to plant it in a test plot somewhere in the state of Minnesota, the Environmental Quality Board will require an environmental impact statement to be done, which is essentially the de facto position now federally, which in a couple of similar examples, the courts have required this anyway. So we'd like this level of protection actually to be in statute, even though it's probably currently there. The second portion of the bill and the amendment that was amended to the majority of the bill, want the DNR to the Department of Natural Resources to do a study in consultation with all interested parties, including the tribes, Department of Agriculture, and others, interested citizens, to look at the threats to wild rice, threats to the environment, water level, pollution, invasive species, and potential genetic strain threats, and to come report back to the legislature on that study. We've requested a fiscal note. I've spoken with Mr. Bagas about that, the DNR. They don't quite have it yet. They'll have it for us soon. Estimated cost somewhere around $20,000. Now, much of that research has already been done. A lot of that will be actually just accumulating the research that the Department of Natural Resources already has, and some with the Department of Agriculture. The last portion of this is also with the Environmental Quality Board. If, in fact, somewhere in the United States there is an introduction of a genetic strain of genetically altered strain of wild rice, the Environmental Quality Board, which already has access to this information, but they're just obligated to communicate that introduction to interested citizens, and there'll be a mechanism for actually signing up for that information. So technically, that's the bill before you, but I have some great experts here who've come a long way to testify. First, I'd like to introduce the tribal chairman from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And I, for those of you who know, I live on Leech Lake tribal land, and so officially, George Gagala is my chairman, and I have the great honor of sitting up here with him again today. So, Chairman.
Welcome, Chairman Gagala. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is George Gagala, Jr., and I'm the chairman for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, as Frank stated. I really would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today as you discuss and deliberate on this important issue. I first would like to extend my thanks and express my gratitude to all of you who participated back in February with our legislative event sponsored by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. I appreciate all of you taking the time, those of you who did take the time, to learn more about our people and how we function as governments in this great state, in this great country. Over the last number of years, many of you have been made aware how we, the Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, feel about our Monomon wild rice. Wild rice is a significant part of our history as a people, part of our creation story as well. We shared our wild rice with the first fur trappers, explorers, and European settlers who came to visit our lands and waters. Some of those settlers were so taken by our wild rice that they named wild rice the Minnesota state grain. And a picture of wild rice adorns the Minnesota state today. Given this recognition, one might presume that wild rice has a particular meaning, perhaps intangible to you and your families as citizens of this fine state. I believe that to be true. The two bills before your committee today, House File 1662, House File 1663, together address the importance of wild rice in Minnesota in the context above my remarks. House File 1662 seeks legislative approval for the state to develop a management plan to protect Minnesota state grain. I am confident that tribal natural resource staff and wild rice community members across the state welcome the opportunity to work with the state DNR staff and this effort. We have been managing wild rice beds for a long time. and the Ojibwe have always been a people who are not afraid to share our knowledge and resources. Working together, we will succeed in this effort. We would like the language out of this bill to strengthen or acknowledge the government-to-government relationship and develop the management plans for the state. We strongly encourage that part. House File 1663 addresses the more controversial but equally important issue of genetically engineered wild rice. I'd like to shed just a little bit of personal perspective on this. I remember my grandfather, when I was real small, the particular season that we gathered wild rice, how big and how important it was to us. I remember climbing a tree when I was too young to participate, to watch my family go out and harvest. I said I was too young, but to me it was something that I'd partaken in for my whole life. I think I was maybe about 4 or 5. But this was something that was very significant to us, to me personally. So I really would like to say this today, that my firsthand knowledge and participation my whole life in the harvesting, the hand parching and finishing of this monument is important to me. It is something that I have had the opportunity to be passed on to me. I have had the opportunity to pass it on to my children with hopes that they will pass it on to theirs as well. It is that significant. It is that important to us. It is morally right in our mind that it be kept the way it is. I'm not sure if many of you understand when I stated earlier that this was part of our creation story. You know, the Creator has given us many, many things in history. And every time we try to alter it or change it, it messes things up. You know, you talk about the invasive species and things that have come into our waters that are not native. I'm afraid that something is going to happen to our rice beds. Leech Lake has, I think we have over 50% of the state's rice beds on our reservation. That means a lot to us. As Representative Mo stated, economically, it is a mainstay of a lot of our families' fall, or what we refer to as school time income. I remember that money that my parents had made during that period of time allowed me to have new clothes for school. That was important. And it's still important today, not only to the Native community, but to non-Native as well. I'd love to invite every one of you up to my home during the season when this grain is harvested and see the enthusiasm, the excitement that exists. You see people riding around with canoes and their poles tied to the top of their vehicles 2 weeks before it even opens, in anticipation for this to happen. This is something that's very meaningful to us. To allow it to be genetically altered would be totally wrong. It would be disrespectful to the first people that inhabited this land. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about this. That's how passionate I am about the wild rice, about what it means to us. Also, equally, our participation in managing it, whether it be on tribal waters, waters that boundary the state and the band's lands as well. I know I only speak for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, but I think and I feel that my words would echo in the same words as the other tribal leaders in the state of Minnesota on this particular issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity today.
Thank you very much, Chairman Gogolai. Are there any questions for Chairman Gogolai or for Representative Moe at this point? I know there are others who want to testify. Okay. And
we'll try to be brief, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Just as Kurt Kalk is getting ready here, I'd just like to let the committee know we have a resolution from all the members of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe in support of this legislation as well, along with a couple other letters of support in the packets. I'd like next to introduce Kurt Kalk, Commissioner of Natural Resources for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe.
Thank you for giving me a chance to speak. My name is Kurt Kalk. I'm the Commissioner of Natural Resources for the Mille Lacs Band. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk a little. I was going to say everything that Chairman Gogolai said, but mine's more of on the environmental end of this, on these two bills. I'm new and not too familiar with bills, but with this comes a long time what was talked about was wild rice also helps us to manage water quality. If you take and change strains of the wild rice, maybe it would live better in poor water quality. Maybe it would live better in different water depths. For many years, we've tried to restore and enhance and protect the areas that were natural to Minnesota and keep them in a natural environment. We notice the more we mess with water levels or try to change them, the more we try to put them back. There's a lot of effort now, even as we work together with the state DNR and tribal DNRs, we try to make sure that we keep a natural environment with that. So I don't know what a person would have to say that we'd like to keep the wild rice natural. There are many invasive species in Minnesota now. We have curly fondleaf weed. We've got zebra mussels. We've got all kinds of different snails, things that were never intended to be here but are. There's one more thing going to crowd out our native species that we have to go out of our way time and time again to try to protect it. Today we have to do many different things to keep these invasive species from moving about. Either we have to change what boat water we're using. We have so many different things to look at that trying to avoid them is really stopping us from harvesting to our full potential at times. I feel like, and our tribe has felt at times, that this is just one more thing that would block the natural harvest, not just to the tribe, but to the other tribal, the non-tribal harvesters. A lot of them don't come here. I don't see any of them here that I know personally that come to all the rice lakes in central Minnesota or Mille Lacs. They don't have the time. They're a labor guy. They're the guy that isn't going to run up to the Capitol today. He's not going to have the time. I'm lucky enough to be hired to do the job for some of them in our community and surrounding community. They too feel that this is something that they've looked for all their lives. They look forward to every year. It has a natural cycle. It has its ups. It has its downs. But we've learned to live with them cycles and how to keep the environment safe. So we've taken our time. But thank you. And support. The Mille Lacs Band also supports these two bills.
Thank you. And any further testimony?
One more. The member of the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Steve Blake, and I'm with the Twin Cities American Indian Movement. I'm a tribal member of the Red Lake Nation, and we also are ricers. We're wild ricers from way back. I remember stories of this wild rice, and the day stories, the creation stories that we have. This rice is spiritual to us. It's medicine for us. We need it. We need it for our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren. This rice heals our people. This rice, if it's genetically engineered, it's not going to work. Uncle Ben's rice does not work. We're trying to get that across. It just doesn't work. We cannot heal our people on that type of rice. We have this rice, and we have been harvesting it for years. There's a certain way of doing it. We do not try to get away from that idea of harvesting that rice, and we will continue to do this. But with your help, we will be able to keep this rice genetic free. And we want to keep this rice for our grandchildren and future generations to come. We're proud of this rice. Matter of fact, I have some rice in the car I just got. And I love it every time I get rice, because we use it in our ceremonies. And I just got through with a double lung transplant. And what helped me heal was the wild rice. And going back to the lodge and getting the wild rice. And when you get that wild rice, it's that medicine that goes into you, giving back to you. And it's just a big circle of life. That rice is real sacred to us. So we ask for your help. We ask that you support this bill and to defend our nations and to work together with our native people, that we can come together and compromise on some sort of agreement on this. It not only affects us, because if you would genetically alter the rice, you would hurt our native people really bad. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. Representative Cornish, you had a question.
Actually, I just wanted to validate their testimony. I used to be a ricer myself, Mr. Gagalayas, up the Dora Lake, Max, Bowstring River, Papa River, up in that area. I used to rice up there, and the Indian warden and I used to post the boundaries of Nature's Lake, and I know how fussy it got when there used to be a boundary issue between the reservation, non-reservation land. You get a foot either way, and who you pay heck to both sides. And I used to chase around the ricers at night when they would be out there, and all you could hear was a whoosh, whoosh when they were harvesting illegally, and we'd go out and catch them on both sides. So it was quite an experience. But just to validate your testimony, it was unbelievable to see the boats line up with the canoes at the public accesses, and the rice laid out, and everybody should get a chance at that, and harvesting the rice in the heat of the day and the worms crawling all over them, and then seeing that beautiful layer of rice in the bottom of the boat with the ends up and things, and how they used to parch it, like you say, and it was quite ceremonial and really impressive. So anything, I just urge support of the bill, I guess.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. And if you'd like to state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Craig Hassel. I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition, and I'm representing myself today. Although I have worked in this issue for 10 years, I've worked with tribal colleges across Minnesota and the upper Midwest, and I specialize in food and nutrition issues that cut across cultural boundaries. And the wild rice issue is certainly an excellent example of that issue. And my experience tells me that passing the proposed legislation can continue the kinds of conversations that we're having here today that will allow for much-needed learning across cultures. At the university, we use science as a powerful set of tools to help us better understand the world, but indigenous people have their own science, too. Should we consider the wild rice as another crop to be domesticated and improved through technology for economic development? Or is wild rice perfect in its natural form, a sacred gift to be protected? Is Western science our only source of genuine knowledge, or might indigenous knowledge offer us valuable understandings? Is it our role as humans to subjugate nature with dominion and control, or perhaps to live more humbly and in harmony with all that is? All human knowledge, including scientific knowledge, is cultural knowledge. Our science depends upon our culture. Healthy tensions between differing cultural worldviews is not always convenient or comfortable, but it can stimulate learning, innovation, and creative solutions. Without this tension, we may not only deprive ourselves of solutions, but we risk complacency and arrogance as well. The wild rice issue challenges those of us at the University of Minnesota to think more about our own preconceived beliefs and foundations. Does our science produce reality itself, or merely a map of reality that we find useful? In 1948, upon viewing our capacity as a nation to wage war, General Omar Bradley remarked, "We have achieved brilliance without wisdom." Solving our societal problems today requires wisdom in addition to scientific knowledge and technology. Wisdom is needed so that broader human benefits are maximized, while unintended consequences, so common nowadays, are minimized. Sound science, after all, exists to help us understand the world and to improve the human condition, not to compromise it. Wild rice is a food protected by treaty law, but it is more than just a food. It is intimately bound to the cultural identity of the Anishinaabe people. To protect wild rice is to protect the Anishinaabe people. Their survival is uniquely tied to the wild rice. What this issue requires is a shift in thinking from vested interest perspectives toward a process of engaging multiple worldviews, each offering their own truths. This work requires that we become more open to different ways of perceiving and understanding our world, to learn to think within other ways of knowing. The proposed legislation and the Wild Rice Management Plan represents sound science. It would encourage all of us, including researchers at the University of Minnesota, to improve our science using the cultural diversity inherent in our great state of Minnesota. And I just want to add that there have been conferences across the Upper Midwest involving not only the tribes of Michigan, but Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. And we find the tribes in Upper Michigan have lost their wild rice. And they're losing their culture. Their ceremonies and their songs are being lost. And so we're seeing what we can do together, working across all of the Upper Midwest and Canada, to try to help keep that cultural loss from occurring. And as I said before, I think the cultural identity of the people are intimately tied to the wild rice. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Moe, if you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have another person who will be available for answering questions, Alan Richardson from the White Earth Land Recovery Project. And I think we'll hold off until if those questions come up about recent developments in the science and also court challenges. I just recognize also that the Farmers Union is currently in support of this legislation, and the University of Minnesota, which took a position against it last year, is now neutral. So there was a good bit of work that's been done with stakeholders. Some are now supportive. Others, I think we got a little bit closer, but I don't think we, as you'll hear, have complete unanimity, but did the best we could.
Okay.
For now, we'll step back, unless there's any questions here, and then we'll maybe take some questions afterwards.
Yeah, any questions before we move on to testimony in opposition? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Moe and Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Phil Griffin. Welcome, and you state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I represent Life Science Alley, and I want to take this moment to thank Representative Moe for the willingness to work with us over the past couple of years on this legislation. Unfortunately, we have not been able to come to an agreement on how to move forward with this bill, and we rise in opposition to the legislation before you. Mr. Chairman and members, Life Science Alley is a trade association representing more than 500 organizations here in Minnesota, mainly in the life sciences area. We've been founded out of the medical device area, but have also merged with the biosciences world. And we bring this concern to you on this legislation in that we don't see anything on the horizon that is moving in this direction, and we don't believe that the bill is necessary for that reason. Mr. Chairman, members, we have four legislative prongs that we are bringing to the legislature this year as concerns. The first one is to promote the life sciences in Minnesota. We need to have a strong education system, both K-12 and higher education. We also believe that there's a need and the second prong to support research and development. And you are doing some very amazing things in this state by supporting the genomics project, the partnership between the University of Minnesota and Mayo, and the Minsky and University systems in their research work. We think those are very, very important things. The third thing that we need to see in Minnesota to move the life sciences forward is economic development. And we have several proposals that are moving through both the Tax Committee and the Appropriations Committees that will help us in those areas to try and move funding forward and spread those things out. But the last thing that we've argued in front of several committees this legislative session and in past years is that we need to have legislative foresight to do no harm. And that is the concern that we have with this legislation. While we agree with you that there are very strong concerns that are being viewed today and that you've heard expressed before you today, we also believe that there is another side to that story, and that is the message that would be sent by the adoption of this kind of legislation, as we would be an isolated state and the only one to have this kind of legislation before. Mr. Chairman and members, those are my brief comments. If there are questions, I'd be happy to address them, but I'd like to turn the microphone over now to Tom Kelleher, who represents BIO, a national trade organization.
Thank you. Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Biotechnology Industry Organization. We have 1,100 members nationwide of industries and companies that work on these sorts of issues. I would just like to echo Mr. Griffin's comments. I won't take up any more committee's time. But we definitely concur that this is an obstacle to some research and find that it is sending a message that possibly if you're considering doing this type of research in Minnesota that there might be some obstacles put before you. And that's some of our concerns in regards to growing an infant industry in which, you know, now the legislature has a committee specifically on the subject matter trying to promote such things such as this. And we're just concerned that this would stymie some of those efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Any questions at all for the testifiers? Representative Breinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of the testifiers, I honestly don't understand why this would be a message contrary to research or future development. It's a very direct protection of a very specific resource with a long-standing sacred history. And I really don't understand. I mean, I'm a supporter of genomic research, but I also believe that there's a reason to be protecting wild rice, and I don't see the contradiction.
Mr. Griffin, or
I'll give it a whirl.
Or Mr. Keller?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Reiner, I think it sets a precedent in a fashion that if some other group or some other group would have opposition to some other sorts of research on a different type of grain or agricultural product, that this would set that precedent, and they would point to that in statute saying, you've done it for this type of product, wild rice in this case, why wouldn't you do it for fill in the blank, so to speak, next commodity? That's probably our concern.
Any further questions? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you absolutely sure that this is going to set a precedent? Because this is a specific instance of a specific group of people that have a legitimate reason for wanting it to remain as it is. I don't think it sets any precedent whatsoever.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Griffin,
Representative, I don't know that there's legislation that we have seen on the books any other state. Am I absolutely certain? No. Death and taxes are about the only thing I'm certain of these days. But the concern that Representative Brown raised is a very legitimate one. And I don't want to belittle the concerns that have been raised both by the chief author of this bill and by the representatives of the tribes and nations that are here today. These are very legitimate concerns, and I hear them strongly. We just are not aware of anybody that's doing research on wild rice in a genetically modified way. We don't think that that's happening currently, and with all due respect, we really don't see the legislation as necessary. But clearly, if I've said anything that states otherwise, I want to be clear about that.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, a couple questions were raised here that we do have answers to. I'd like to, if we could have 1 minute for Alan Richardson from the White Earth Land Recovery Project, who has done extensive survey of the research and local or most recent legal cases around this. If he could present that information for a minute, that could be helpful.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. And Mr. Richardson, welcome. And if you can state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Alan Richardson. I'm the outreach coordinator with White Earth Land Recovery Project on the campaign to protect Lake Rice from contamination by engineered genes. First, I want to state that you know, the tribal governments have obligations to protect these resources that are embedded in treaty rights. So that needs to be given some additional consideration, but. I have to take issue with the previous speaker's contention that there are no precedents on this point. The standard argument used by opponents of our legislation is that anything which restricts biotechnology sends a chilling message to the research dollars, implying that biotechnology interests will reduce their investment in the state if wild rice is protected by engineered genes, or that it can be used as a precedent to restrict such things as genetically modified corn or soy, which are already commercially available, or something like wheat, where certain agricultural interests would like to see it genetically engineered. In June of last year, the University of Hawaii chose to honor the wishes of Native Hawaiians by agreeing not to patent or genetically engineered taro, which is a sacred and essential food source for Native Hawaiians, in the same way that wild rice is to the Ojibwe. This clearly establishes in academic terms that plants and crops, which are traditional forms of spiritual and economic sustenance for Native people, are in a unique and distinct category. In fact, a 10-year moratorium on the patenting and genetic engineering of taro has since passed the Hawaiian State Senate. And neither of these decisions to protect taro have had any negative impact on Hawaii's economy, and Hawaii's biotech sector remains one of the most robust in the nation. In your packets, you will find a couple of news stories about the economic catastrophe which has affected the white rice industry as the result of contamination by engineered genes. Contamination refers specifically to unregulated experimental engineered genes which escape from their test plots and you know, get somewhere where they're not supposed to be. In this case, the white rice crop, which has experienced the catastrophic loss of foreign sales as a result. They've had three instances of contamination very recently. And So having said that, the situation, the precedent's already been established in Hawaii, and because the crux of our issue is based on wild rice's uniqueness, there is literally no way that this legislation could be used as a precedent to in any way impact other genetically engineered products of any kind. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Richardson. Any questions at all? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're in a bit of a rush, so I'll try to make this real quick. Representative Moll, on page one, you changed the words to federally recognized tribes. They're to be notified of any action. I'm wondering if you wanted to include the words within Minnesota, so we don't have to have a nationwide notification of all tribes.
Mr. Representative Moll. Representative Osmond, I would take that as a friendly amendment. That's a good clarifying language.
Mr. Chair, I believe that doesn't do any harm to his intent, and it does narrow down the task that we're talking about. If we could just, after the words federally recognized tribes, insert within Minnesota, I'd make that motion.
Okay. Representative Osmond moves that we add the words in Minnesota after federally recognized tribes. Is that correct?
Within Minnesota. Right?
Within Minnesota. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Osmond.
One other. On your second amendment that you adopted, there is a new section called construction, and I'm wondering why that's needed. It's cautioning us about that this does not affect, alter, or modify other laws and so forth. Was there a specific need for that, or that's an unusual statement?
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, thanks for bringing that to our attention. We working with the tribes, based on agreements that they have around other issues, it was important to them legally, recognizing our state-to-state relationship with them, that we include that language, so we agreed to do that.
So we would call that more like comfort language then for the tribe?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Osmond.
One other comment that I'd like to make, and that is in 22 years that I've been here, yesterday I had the opportunity to be briefed on this by Mr. Richardson, and I don't think I have ever had such a good quality briefing in such a short period of time in my experience here, and so I just wanted to compliment him on that.
Thank you. And Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chairman, I have a procedural question that might be better at the end after the substantive issues get raised, but I can certainly ask
Representative questions. McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a real short statement. Representative Moe, thanks for bringing this forward. I think it's important for all members in the audience to realize the special importance of wild rice, and we have done some great genetically altering of different things, trees, agricultural products, and such, to the benefit of society. But I will say, folks, this is a different thing, and I'm not sure we want to be going down the road of fooling with it. So I appreciate you bringing this legislation forward, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. And any other questions on the bill? Representative Mariani, you had a procedural question.
Mr. Chair, I apologize because I've been stepping in and out this evening, but what is the motion for? Where does this bill supposedly going to go from here?
To government operations.
And Mr. Chair, I was told that, and I'm looking at the language, and I'm trying to understand why it needs to go to government operations.
Chair?
Representative Moe.
Representative Mariani, there's rulemaking provision in the language that requires the Environmental Quality Board to commence rulemaking for how to go about requiring the environmental impact statement, and rulemaking is the purview of government operations. I've spoken with Chairman Pulaski, and he agrees to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, if that's your desire, and I don't know about this committee. I mean, in my committee, we have rulemaking authority as well that does it for a number of bills that wind up not going to government ops. The commissioner or commissioners of the boards that we deal with have rulemaking authority. Does the Environmental Quality Board possess rulemaking authority?
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murray, my understanding is they do. For a little more information, the Environmental Quality Board is within Representative Kahn's committee, so we probably will have to go there as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, and I certainly will follow the lead of the author in this regard. Quite frankly, members, I'd be comfortable sending this straight to the floor. But I certainly would defer to the author in this regard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe. I would prefer to go to the floor too, yet that's not my option. So, and I will speak again with Representative Pulaski if he can be, his mind could be changed. I would just as soon go to finance, but I don't think that will happen yet.
So, any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I really appreciate your extended time giving attention to this issue. It's been a lot of work for many people to get through a committee. Is quite a success for us. We appreciate that. I'd like to renew my motion to pass House File 1663 as amended to be referred to government operations.
Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 1663, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, members of the tax committee is going to come into the room at 6 p.m. For their hearing. The chair of the committee has two bills up. The DNR is passing out a technical corrections bill. Chair Ethan?
We also have another bill up as well. We have House File 1418. I would like to move House File 1418. It would be recommended to pass and referred to Committee on Government Operations. And that is the technical DNR technical bill.
Eakin moves the DNR technical bill, House File 1418. Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Our House File 1418 is the department's technical bill. We just have one small author's amendment.
I would like to amend that we delete Section 5 of House File 1418.
You can move leading Section 5. Any discussion? All those in favor on the Eakin amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. To the bill as amended.
Mr. Members, thank you. As I mentioned, this is a technical bill, and I'm just going to run through section by section. You should have a fact sheet with you as well. Section 1 of the bill allows our game and fish expedited rules to become permanent. Right now, they expire after 18 months, and we have to go through the rulemaking process. These are the mundane, daily rulemaking things that we do. Section 2 of the bill clarifies that infested waters that are connected, such as Voyageurs National Park, that when a portion of that is infested, we can designate the whole body, and it exempts this process from rulemaking. You'll see there on 2.13. Sections 3 and 4 of the bill are cleaning up the existing statutes dealing with that exemption from rulemaking. We remove Section 5. Section 6 allows us to deal with alternative means of all state park entrance fees by commissioner order, going through the types of machines that we have around the parking lots here where you put in a stall number and you get a receipt, Iron Ranger we call it. Section 7 deals with some language that actually passed last year with Representative Tinglestad on veterans allowing them into parks, clarifying how that's done. The language that passed allowed them to put their orders on their dashboard. We don't want people putting active military orders on their dashboards and going to enjoy our parks. It's just that now they'll come into the park center, we'll give them a sticker just like anybody else. Section 8 of the bill extends the sunset provision for the Minerals Coordinating Commission. This is a committee made up of union representatives, state officials, and other people to help direct the state in their mining activities. Sections 9 and 10 and 11 of the bill relate to water supply planning requirements in the Metro County. This comes out of the Water Supply, Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee, established in 2005 in statute. Helps the Met Council develop their master water supply plan, provides recommendations for streamlining and consolidating water supply approval processes, is what they're trying to do. There's two sections of statutes related to water supply plans. This clarifies that one plan satisfies both of those requirements, and it's helping streamline those reporting activities. Section 11 deletes the water supply plan references in the Met Council statutes and replaces it with language in 103G DNR statute found in Section 9. And it clarifies that regional plans must be consistent with state plans, and the master water supply plan is currently being developed. And then Section 12 is the repealer dealing with the military veterans language that I spoke of earlier.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Eakin,
one additional oral amendment, also on the repealer. They have the wrong chapter number, which is from last year. Strike 236, Article 1, on line 72, and state 273.
Mr. Helen, do you have?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion on the Eakin amendment? Oh, Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would read on line 7.2, clause 2006, chapter 273, section 2.
That is correct.
Okay.
Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. To the motion as amended, or to the Representative Eakin?
Yes. I would like to renew my motion that the House file 1418 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations as amended.
Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it, and the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. We have House File 1674, Representative Eakin.
I would like to move that House File 1674 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Representative Eakin.
And I also have an amendment. I would like to also move Amendment A070356.
Eakin moves Amendment A070356. Representative Wagenius.
I would like to propose an amendment to your amendment. Would you like me to do it after it's adopted, or should I suggest it now?
Why don't we wait until after it's adopted?
Any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The amendment is, amendment is adopted. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you. As we are looking to for changes to statutes, rules, and procedures to improve biofuels permitting process, I would like, after the word process to add the words and reduce the groundwater needed for production. So as we're doing a study, I think we all recognize that that's one of the outstanding issues here, and this would be a good opportunity to do it all at once.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eakin.
Yes. Maybe to repeat the amendment, maybe on line 1.12, reduce the groundwater needed
for production.
For production.
So it would be recommended changes to reduce the groundwater needed for production.
Thank you. And
Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chair, I would accept that amendment. So I would encourage your support.
We do need to vote on that amendment. So, Mr. Allen, do you have the amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Does everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor of the Wagenius amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. To the bill as amended, is there any further discussion? Any further discussion? Representative Eakin?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill which would conduct a study and it's a very simple bill. It would be... the Pollution Control Agency, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and the Environmental Quality Board would report back to the House and the Senate that they have jurisdiction over ag and environment policy. As far as the process of issuing permits for biofuel production facilities, there is a problem with some of the timing on the permitting for these facilities. It's taken a great deal of time in some cases. I know that the PCA has been working on this and has, I think, been doing a good job in trying to cut down the amount of time. But this would simply study the process further and try to expedite the situation so that permits can be done in a more timely manner. So with that, I would ask for your support.
Any further discussion? Representative Eakin. And I would like to renew my motion that House File 1674, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No further business. The meeting is adjourned.